important when we're thinking about this issue, the relationship between sick and disabled people in society, to recognise the long history that the state of the state's involvement in trying to address these kinds of issues has. And I thought I'd continue with another kind of big quote from Zygmunt Bauman in his book Wasted Lives, published in 2004, where he says that the production of human waste, or more correctly, wasted humans, is an inescapable side effect of order building. Each order casts some parts of the extant population as out of place, unfit, or undesirable, and of economic progress, progress that cannot proceed without degrading and devaluing the previously effective modes of making a living, and therefore cannot but deprive their practitioners of their livelihood. And there are lots of people who are making similar kinds of comments about the way in which progress and the way in which the state responds to economic development and tries to shape economic development takes place. Richard Sennett, another person who writes very interestingly about the big picture in relation to these issues, talks about the way in which the idea of work as some kind of meaningful activity, maybe a hard activity, but nonetheless a meaningful one, in terms of people's lives, has been thrown up in the air and has fallen in pieces on the ground as people are increasingly finding themselves in jobs where they've got short-term contracts and where they're moving constantly between different kinds of work. So that idea of work as something that's coherent and cohesive and that has some kind of future for people is much more difficult for people to feel that they can hang on to now than it was in the past, according to Bauman and Sennett and others. Now, I'm going to talk to you about incapacity. You'll be familiar with the current debate on incapacity and incapacity benefits. I'm going to talk a little bit about the kind of, not the really detailed detail, but some of the specifics of that. And then I'm going to go on to talk a little bit about some paradoxes that I see as being embedded within discussions of incapacity. So when people talk about incapacity, they're not just talking about disability or chronic illness. They're talking about something that has been used customarily in relation to the issue of work and benefits. And it's typically defined as something like the inability to work associated with sickness or disability. So, in a sense, there's something very straightforward. Someone becomes ill, or they have an injury, or something happens to them, and they can no longer perform the job that they're in, and they go on to some kind of benefit. An incapacity benefit has been the benefit that many people who've been on long-term sickness have been given as a replacement for their income. And in some ways, it's anachronistic talking about incapacity benefit now, because at the end of the last government's tenure of office, incapacity benefit was abolished for new claimants and replaced by something called employment and support allowance. But nonetheless, the issue of incapacity remains, even if the terminology in the clever way of politicians is shifting in all kinds of ways. So incapacity is disability as it relates to the inability to work. And back in 2006, when incapacity benefits still existed, incapacity benefit was defined as a benefit which gives working age people a replacement income when they become sick or disabled and stop working or looking for work as a result. So it was recognised that some people would be ill or disabled in some way that would not only prevent them working, but actually would defeat the idea of them looking for work at all. And incapacity has existed like that for a long time, but it's become important in the last few years, both in the last years of the Labour government and, for a substantial period of the last Labour government, and with the new coalition government that we've got at the present time. Why is incapacity important? Well, there are several reasons. First of all, the number of people on long-term incapacity benefits has trebled since 1979 and now amounts to somewhere over 2.5 million people in the population. At least that's the figure that's often quoted. Incapacity is unequally distributed across social classes and regions. It's closely related to, but not the same as, measures of limiting long-term illness, and I'll say a bit about that. Interestingly, mental and behavioural problems have overtaken musculoskeletal problems, joints and backs and things, as the main medical reason for incapacity, and it's closely linked to poverty deprivation and regional economic decline. So incapacity, in a way, embodies, it seems to me, something about the interrelationship between economies and human beings as workers or non-workers in some very interesting and powerful ways. And I suppose the question that needs to be asked when we look at rates of incapacity benefit is, are we looking at something that is an economic or labour force statistic, or are we looking at something that's a health statistic? Because if you look at the, and I'll show you some pictures in a minute, there's some people from Scotland here, aren't there? I've got a map of Scotland. I didn't have one, but Gareth Rees, when he came back to the department, said, there's some Scots there, so I quickly put in a map of Scotland just to make you feel included. I mean, you're familiar with the debate over inequality in income and wealth, and also inequality in health. So incapacity kind of mirrors those kinds of inequalities. But it's something that is obviously both about economy and health, and I'll come and just try and unpack some of that as I go along. Now, if you look at the incapacity claimant rates, England and Wales, this is the most recent data that I could find presented in some kind of manageable form. Percentages of the population of working age. Basically, there are high rates of incapacity claimants in South Wales, northwest of England, and just spreading across, and northeast of England. And South Wales and northeast of England, in particular, have very, very high rates of incapacity claimants. And we'll talk a bit about why that's the case in a minute. And then my Scottish map. What part of Scotland are you from?
Edinburgh.
Of course, you don't have these kinds of problems in Edinburgh, because it's very posh. But certainly in the west of Scotland, it's a major issue in terms of the regional economy and the regional health service. There are very high rates of incapacity claimants also in Glasgow and the west of Scotland. What's that island off there? Okay. So it spreads out. And of course, what often happens when you look at these maps, in Scotland, people often talk about the Glasgow effect, as if there's something Glaswegian about the fact that life expectancy is low. Okay? And we have to be very careful about slipping into those ways of thinking, because what we're looking at is, of course, you know, globally driven regional economic inequalities. We're not looking at the culture of particular towns and places. And the same in South Wales, where people will talk in equally disparaging ways about Merthyr Tydfil and other communities in the Rhondda and the Cumann. So this is just to show you that the claimant rate varies, as I've said, in terms of region and place. And most interestingly, I think, incapacity rates have increased dramatically over time. And this graph in particular has led the authors whose work I've taken this from, Christina Beattie and Steve Fothergill in Sheffield, to argue that when you're looking at incapacity over time, the message that one has to take from it is that incapacity cannot be related to changes in the health of the population, because the health of the population, except in some very small parts of some areas, has generally improved. Okay, so if health's improving, health can't be driving the increase in the rate of incapacity benefit claims, they suggest. So what they argue is that when we look at incapacity benefit claims, what we're looking at primarily is something driven by changes in the labour market, i.e. loss of jobs, redundancy, closure of old industries, all those kinds of things, not changes in the health of the population. And yet, as I've said, incapacity is both something that relates to economy and to health. And I want to just kind of unpack what I think is a slightly paradoxical situation, but certainly you wouldn't be able to explain the increase in incapacity benefit claims over that period, 1963 to 2009, on the basis of a deterioration in the overall health of the population. So there's something about labour markets and so on that's driving the incapacity benefit claims. And as Amy will know, and some of the rest of you may as well, there's a lot of changes taking place over this time in terms of who's in power and so on, and also changes in the definition and the rules for claiming different kinds of benefit. I think 1995 was the year that incapacity benefit came into existence. Before that, it had been called invalidity benefit. And the changes in the rates of incapacity need to be seen in relation to some of those kinds of developments within government. So what Steve Fothergill and his colleagues argue is that incapacity is primarily a labour market problem. They say it's no exaggeration to say that incapacity benefit lies at the heart of the current labour market problem in the valleys and in much of the rest of older industrial Britain as well, the places that we saw on those maps. Reliance on IB is by far and away the most common form of benefit dependency among working age men and women and one of the principal forms of social exclusion. So they're saying that incapacity benefit is about changes in the labour market, the loss of jobs, the increase in the numbers, the changes in the kind of work available in different places. And, of course, what their work and the work of other people shows is that although the flow onto incapacity benefit was particularly marked at the time of the closure of traditional industries, both coal and steel and other manufacturing industries, it's continued to be something which people have come on to for different reasons. So what they argue is that the early increase in the incapacity benefit rate was due to the loss of jobs in coal mining, steel and other manufacturing. And then more recently, what we're seeing is the coming on to incapacity benefit of people who have some kind of health problem and who lack the skills and the ability to be able to engage in rapidly changing labour market that that exists within the UK. So in a sense you could say that there are two discourses of incapacity, and you can see incapacity as an employment problem, an indicator of worklessness or economic inactivity, and you can see incapacity as a health problem, some kind of objective correlate of subjective measures of limiting long-term illness and disability, which we see reported in censuses and surveys. Now, one of the interesting things I mentioned before is that when you look at the causes or reasons underlying incapacity claims, we've got a situation now, and this is data from both the Department of Work and Pensions' own data and also a survey that Beattie and Fothergill conducted in 2006-2007. What it shows is the very high numbers of people who are on benefit because of mental and behavioural problems. And this marks a big shift from musculoskeletal dominance of incapacity at the time when people were first coming onto benefit from coal mining and steel. So it's a different kind of population with different sorts of problems being diagnosed and defined in different kinds of ways by the doctors. And of course, I mean, one of the things to understand about this, I'm not going to have time to go into all the detail of this, is that I mean, when people get onto incapacity benefit, they have to go through a pretty, well, and certainly an increasingly rigorous process of initially seeing their GP and then being seen by a doctor specialising in making decisions about whether or not people go on to incapacity benefit or not. So people who are on incapacity have been through a rigorous process of being defined as people who are not necessarily unable to work in anything under any circumstances, but certainly would find most forms of work difficult to manage. And I think we're moving to a situation, Amy, where people are being expected to prove that they can't work in any kind of work in any situation whatsoever. We're moving to a much more tough approach to assessing people to see whether they justify incapacity benefit or is now employment and support allowance or not. But the rise of mental and behavioural problems as the underlying reason for incapacity is an important issue. I just want to show you some of the data on limiting long-term illness. There's a question on limiting long-term illness in the census. And there's also been one in the General Household Survey over a long period of time. And what this shows you is, even if that graph showing the rise in incapacity claims is driven by changes in the labour market rather than changes in people's health, the patterns of health are very similar to the patterns of incapacity benefit claims. So what you've got here are the percentages of people who say they have some kind of limiting long-term illness. Limiting means that they can't, it stops them doing things. And you can see you've got that kind of typical sort of gradient going from very low percentages in the southeast of England to higher percentages in the northeast of England, Wales, and Northern Ireland. again, this is the proportion of adults aged 45 to 64 who have a limiting long-standing illness in Wales, North East and Northern Ireland, showing that it's almost, that the rates in Wales, the North East and Northern Ireland are almost double those in the South East, right? So the same patterns that you saw for incapacity benefit you see in relation to long-term illness. And this shows the local authorities with the highest and lowest rates of limiting long-term illness. 2001, I mean, I know it's very old data now, we'll be having a new census, we hope, soon. And on the left, it shows the areas with the lowest rates of limiting long-term illness, all in the southeast of England. On the right, it shows the local authority areas with the highest rates of limiting long-term illness. Five of the top 10 are in Wales. So you're getting very similar kinds of patterns, although, of course, you can't draw any conclusions from the fact that they share these kinds of patterns, except to say that clearly incapacity is situated between, it's situated in social contexts and populations where high rates of ill health and high rates of loss of work coexist. So there is obviously a pattern of relationships, but not easy to draw conclusions. Those are the questions, first of all, from the census. It asks, do you have any long-term illness, health problem, or disability which limits your daily activity or the work you can do? And a similar kind of question from the General Household Survey. So we have that kind of subjective data, as people curiously refer to it. That is data that is based on people giving their own answers to questions that they're asked. Whereas incapacity is a different kind of measure of the numbers of people in the population who have been passed as justifying being put onto incapacity benefits. So they're different sorts of data. Now, way back in 1998, in an interesting paper by some epidemiologists down in London, they were puzzling over what it was that was driving these high rates of limiting long-term illness. And it is quite interesting because you know, when you look at life expectancy and mortality statistics, it's west of Scotland that comes out as being kind of way off the scale in terms of poor health, if you take that as the measure of poor health. But if you look at limiting long-term illness, in fact, South Wales and the northeast of England have higher rates than not hugely higher, but marginally higher than the west of Glasgow and the west of Scotland. And so there's obviously something kind of going on in limiting long-term illness that isn't the same as looking at mortality or life expectancy. And the point they make is, in some ways, an obvious one, but one which often gets lost in the policy discussion, is that the perception of oneself as having a limiting illness may be a combination of the effect of underlying ill health and the availability or non-availability of central social roles, such as employment as the breadwinner. The heavy concentration of LLTI in certain areas may be explainable in terms of the shifting availability of such roles to men who are also at high risk of disease. So in a sense, back in 1998, they were making the same point, but coming at it from a different position, that Fothergill and Beattie and others have made in relation to incapacity, which is that there is this very complex relationship between the way in which labour markets function, the kinds of people who are available to take up work when it's offered, and people's own understanding of their capacity in health terms to engage with the labour market in different sorts of ways. Now, one of the other things that Beattie and Fothergill have done recently, in a recent paper this last year, is to, they did a survey of people who are in receipt of incapacity benefit in different parts of England, and they asked them a series of questions, which I did actually... I was trying to do kind of some complicated cut and paste to actually show you the tables and graphs they used, but failed miserably, and things were becoming elongated and stretched and collapsing in on themselves and all kinds of stuff. So I've had to just do a little bit of a summary slide here for you. But they asked people a whole series of questions. For example, what was the principal reason for you losing your job? 70% of women and 74% of men said illness or injury, as opposed to being made redundant or something else. So high percentage of people said that their reason for job loss was a health-related one. Main reason for them not wanting a job, 93% of men and women said that their health was not good enough. Obstacles to finding work, 91% of women and 93% of men said it's because of an illness or injury or a disability. And they also asked them, what would potential employers think about you? And 53% of women and 56% of men said they'd think that I was too ill or disabled to do the job. And in fact, they had other categories as well, like that I would be too great a risk for the employer, which in a way is possibly also a health-related issue. So if you added all those together, it would be a significant, I mean, the majority of their sample said that employers would regard them as being too ill or disabled for work. So you can see how this business about what it means to talk about ill health or disability that prevents you from working, how complicated it is to disentangle in terms of what makes people unfit for work and what makes people fit for work. And the sense that the state has to be very careful about being too liberal in allowing people access to benefit, of course, is something which has been part of the discussion about the nature of the welfare state and how it should operate since the welfare state was first set up. And indeed, there's a nice quote from Beveridge, which I haven't got here, where Beveridge, who of course was the man who set up the welfare state effectively, saying that you have to be very careful about paying people benefit for too long at too high a rate, he said, in case they become habituated to not working. So, although I like to blame everything on Margaret Thatcher, as indeed I'm sure many of the rest of you do as well, in fact, that sense of a moral question about what unfitness for work means was at the very heart of the early discussion about what the welfare state should do and should not do for people within the population of the UK. So, you know, a lot of people, notably editors of the News of the World and the Daily Mail, would look at statistics like this and they'd say, well, of course they're going to say that, aren't they? You know, these people, they're all lying and cheating and engaged in sort of systematic deception of the decent people of this country, the hard-working people, to use the phrase that's trotted out on a regular basis these days. And that is an issue that underlies a lot of the discussion now and over the last few years about what it is that a welfare state should be. Okay, so you can begin to see how looking at these kinds of things and thinking about what incapacity means begins to open up a set of moral and political questions about the obligations of the state and the nature of people's own obligations to the state. And of course, Tony Blair, in a very early green paper on welfare, said that there should be work for those who can and support for those who can't work. That idea, and beginning to develop that idea of rights and responsibilities within a population. So this issue of incapacity, what it means, lies at the very heart of the discussion about the nature of the welfare state and the relationship of citizens to it. And particularly, I think, in the context of the shift from musculoskeletal disorders as being the main reasons for incapacity claims to mental and behavioural problems, it's kind of heated up that discussion in quite a big way, because I always remember a professor of general practice in Manchester when I worked there saying to me, show me a working class man with backache on benefit and I'll show you a liar, was his statement. Professors of general practice can somehow get away with speaking in that kind of way. So, but even more so, I think, with mental health problems, it becomes questionable. You know, questionable to the government, questionable to other people. You know, if someone says, well, I'd love to work, but I'm depressed. Okay, so there's a lot of stuff going on underneath the macro picture of incapacity that I think is feeding into some of the discussions that we've got at the moment. You know, questions about, can you really not do anything at all? You know, can't you just, you know, and this is true. Now, I've had conversations with people. I had a conversation with someone recently whose husband has had serious operation for cancer, who said that they were putting her under pressure, putting him under pressure, to get back to work. And although these are only anecdotal things, we need to draw out of these anecdotal things a certain kind of thinking about what's going on in the way in which the state relates to the needs of people who have different sorts of health problems. So here you've got people's kind of subjective views of what we can and cannot do and why, and then you've got the state with its assessment procedures for incapacity and now employment and support allowance, trying in a sense to test these kinds of things out in some rigorous but rather crude forms of medical examination and testing.